thanks to Kipper and Pals, and welcome this evening to Evening Under Lamplight, the show that invites you to attend. We're here on Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city, and I'm Robert Louis Abrahamson. You can reach me at RLA at momentsunderlamplight.com, and our archives are posted at momentsunderlamplight.com. That's our introductory shtick. We're now at the equinox, and so, all things being equal, let's move on to what's in store this evening under lamplight. We can't meet here this week without mention of the Scottish referendum, a moment in British history that I think will grow in significance as time passes. This referendum occasioned more genuine debate and more engagement than any other vote I can think of. The press, as usual, made efforts to control and direct the debates, but the discussions were taking place among the people themselves, as it should be. I was pleased to see that it's still alive, that ancient Scottish character of hostility to any kind of pretense or control from above. I want to salute that spirit by inviting you to look with me, under lamplight, at an important poem, or song, rather, by Robert Burns, A Man's a Man for All That. Let me read it through first, and then let's try to bring it to life and finish off with a sung version. Is there for honest poverty that hangs his head and all that, the coward slave, we pass him by, we dar be poor for all that. For all that and all that, our toils obscure and all that, the rank is but the guinea's stamp, the man's the gold for all that. What though unhamely fair we dine, we're hodden grey and all that, gee fools their silks and knaves their wine, a man's a man for all that. For all that and all that, their tinsel show and all that, the honest man, though e'er say poor, is king o' men for all that. You see yon birkie called a lord, wha struts and stares and all that, though hundreds worship at his word, he's but a coof for all that. For all that and all that, his ribbon star and all that, the man o' independent mind, he looks and laughs at all that. A prince can mak a belted knight, a marquis, duke and all that, but an honest man's a boon his might, good faith he munna for that. For all that and all that, their dignities and all that, the pith o' sense and pride o' worth are higher rank than all that. Then let us pray that come it may, as come it will for all that, that sense and worth o'er all the earth shall bear the gree and all that. For all that and all that, it's coming yet for all that, that man to man the world o'er shall brothers be for all that. This is a wonderful hymn to humanity, if we overlook Burns' exclusively male point of view here. Understandable, given Burns' cultural and psychological context. Burns was above all a songmaker. Most of his songs concerned love and drinking. What Burns recognized were the traditional subjects for lyrics. But he was aware that this song diverged from the tradition. With mock humility, he downplayed the lyrics, declaring that since they were not about love or wine, this was not really a song, but just two or three pretty good prose thoughts inverted into rhyme. Well, it's a little more than that, as we might see as we go on. Robert Burns, the ploughman poet, was celebrated as the simple self-taught poet whose genius flourished because he was close to nature rather than to the schools. But his poetry usually shows that he studied the great poets very carefully. The whole point of this poem, for instance, that we must judge a person by what is inside, not by external labels, is taken from the Stoic philosophy passed down in classic literature. This poem follows the classical tradition of opening with a question. The Psalms do this often too. And with a witty condensing of ordinary speech, which goes back at least as far as the Latin poet Horace. Is there for honest poverty that hangs his head and all that? Inverted back into prose, what he is saying is this: is there any honest person who hangs his head in shame because he is poor and all that? All those things that go with poverty, like oppression, being despised by others, never having enough to live comfortably. Is there anyone like this? We today might almost say, hands up anyone who hangs his head in shame, etc. But once that person puts his hand up, Burns has a reply. The coward slave, we pass him by, we dare be poor for all that. Such a person is a slave, just putting up with his inferior position, and a coward at that, because lacking the courage to stand up for himself. We, Burns says, thus drawing together both himself and all of us, we dare be poor for all that. Knowing all that poverty entails, we still dare to be poor. We stand up proudly, not browbeaten. That's you and I, honest folk, Ken. Our toil's obscure. No one is going to be paying much attention to the kind of lowly jobs we do in life. But we know our value does not rest on that. The rank is but the guinea's stamp. Does this need a footnote? A guinea was a gold coin, and like all coins, it was stamped or minted with the embossed image of the monarch and a few words telling the value of the coin. But we know that this guinea piece is valuable not because its inscription tells us it's worth 21 shillings, but because it is made of gold. Similarly, our social position, our rank, is just the outer stamp labeling us, but it's our inner worth that indicates our true value. The man's the gold for all that. Thus has Burns established his theme that a man's a man for all that, for all that may superficially indicate otherwise. The next stanza looks at accoutrements of everyday life. What does it matter if we eat hamely fare, poor man's food, such as porridge or haggis and cheap ale, or wear hodden grey, that is coarse, homespun woolen clothes, undyed, and thus a mixture of white and dark wool making it grey? What does it matter if we give fools their fine silk clothes and knaves and scoundrels their wine? Their habits of life may be radically different from ours, but again, that's only superficial. A man's a man for all that. Fancy things are just a tinsel show. The honest man, and here honest means someone who has lived a life of integrity, true to his own inner convictions and honour. The honest man, even though poor, is king o' men for all that. And now we focus in on one person, yon Berkey, called a lord. A Berkey is a conceited man, and we have to picture the kind of aristocrat Burns has in mind. Someone who has real power, whose displeasure could have you thrown into jail or transported overseas to the colonies, who owns lots of land with an enormous income, often to be spent in riotous living like the prodigal son. The closest thing we have today, perhaps, are those people belonging to the 1%. The CEOs and company chairmen living lives far removed from ours, who have the police, the courts, and the politicians in their pocket. But how often do we see these people? Almost never, not even in the media. They keep a low profile. But an 18th century aristocrat was a public figure and was known especially by his showiness. Most people would have seen an aristocrat at least once or twice, and been scorned by them most likely as they strut and stare. Why stare? With raised eyebrows, they might notice us and look down in amazement at our audacity in actually being there before turning and dismissing us from their mind. This Berkey has power. Hundreds worship at his word. Oh, yes, my lord, of course, my lord. And yet, for all that, he's but a coof. A fool, looking idiotic in his fancy dress, his ribbon and star, the Order of the Garter or other decoration worn in public occasions. Once we honest folk see through these trappings, what can we do but look and laugh at all that? After all, A prince can mak a belted knight. I dub thee Sir John so-and-so, or any other noble title. It's only a human being who has conferred this outward dignity, but no prince can make an honest man. An honest man's a boon or above his might. Good faith, he mon afford that. He mustn't lay claim to that sort of thing. I'm an honest man. No mere prince made me like that. I have integrity deep down within me, my pith o' sense, the essence of good sense, and pride o' worth, as opposed to pride of wealth, are higher rank than all that. And then the final stanza, which turns into a prayer, praying that this pith o' sense and pride o' worth may bear the gree, that is, win the prize, hold the highest place in the way we value other people. And twice Burns asserts that this day will come, as come it will for all that. It's coming yet for all that. When man to man the world o'er shall brothers be for all that. There's not much one can say against this. We all know that the true value of a human being rests on the person's character, if not his or her soul. Even though most of the time, even the most honest among us are seduced by one or another kind of outward show, it's a revolutionary song if we take it seriously. But it's the kind of revolution we should all welcome. It's not based on cries for equal pay or even equal rights. These are outward things. It's a calling for us all to be brothers and sisters. That is, acknowledging that we are all related, all connected at some deeper level. Once we realize this, the equal pay and equal treatment will come naturally. Science keeps telling us today that all people are connected, and of course, the mystics are always reminding us of this. But here's Burns with his vivid Scots language in what is really just a simple, short song, confirming this in a way that can reach everyone. But I wonder whether the poem or song might seem like envy or some kind of sour grapes. I can't be rich and powerful, and so I laugh at wealth and power as unimportant. Well, yes, all declarations by the powerless can be made to seem like envy or spite. But that's where our literary sharpness comes in. What is the tone of the poem? How does it handle its material? The chief feature of the poem surely is defiance, a position we can hold only when we have confidence in ourselves, only when we are grounded and know ourselves as a man or independent mind. This is the very opposite of envy, in which I am dissatisfied with what I have and imagine that I'd be happier if I had what you have. And it's the opposite of sour grapes, in which, unable to have what I desire, I renounce all desire and just slink off like the fox in the fable. We also want to take note of the effect of the repetition of "for all that." A man's a man for all that. It may well be great to have silks and wine and all that power, but nevertheless, it's ultimately not as important as integrity. This is an example, excuse me, I'm going to get a little arcane here, an example of the nevertheless principle. Muriel Spark once wrote an article stating that nevertheless was the single word that defined the Edinburgh temperament. It's the frame of mind that is always alert to contraries, a contrary disposition, we might say. Aye, it's a fine morning. Nevertheless, I've brought my umbrella. She's wearing a bonny jacket the day. Nevertheless, who wants to be seen with such an old kimmer? Kimmer or cummer, that's a Scots word for a yenta. There are many, many versions of the song, but Ewan McCall's version was the first I heard, and it still remains, to my ear, the most powerful rendition, pared down to just a voice, no instrument, perhaps a little too much vibrato, but perhaps not.
Is there for honest poverty that hangs his heed and all that? The coward's sleeve, we pass him by, we dor be peer for a' that. For a' that, and a' that, our toil's obscure, and a' that. The rank is but the Guinness stamp, the man's the gowd for a' that. What though unheemly fair we dine, we're hodden grey, and a' that. Gie fools their silks and knaves their wine, a man for a' that. For a' that and a' that, their tinsel show and a' that. The honest man, though e'er sae pair, is king o' men for a' that. Ye see yon birkie ca'd a lord, wha struts and stares and a' that. Though hundreds worship at his word, he's but a coof for a' that. For a' that, and a' that, his ribbon star, and a' that. The man o' independent mind, he looks and laughs at a' that. A prince can make a belted knecht, a marquis, duke, and a' that. But an honest man's aboon his mecht, get faithy mona for that. For a' that and a' that, their dignities and a' that. The pith o' sense and pride o' worth are higher rank than a' that. Then let us pray that come it may, as come it will for a' that. That sense and worth our o' the earth shall bear the gree and o' that. For o' that and o' that, it's coming yet for o' that. That man to man the world o'er shall brothers be for o' that.
And that was Ewan McCall singing Robert Burns' anthem, A Man's a Man for All That. You may have been thinking that what Burns is talking about is quite similar to what Whitman has been talking about in our excursion through his Song of Myself. We see the same distinction between all those external things that are not the me, myself, and the deep soul, whom Whitman invites to come lie with him in the grass, and with whom, as we saw a few weeks ago, he enacts a kind of spiritual, sexual intercourse. Last time, we saw Whitman trying to give an honest and poetic answer to the child asking him, "What is the grass?" Whitman's response to the child led to a short meditation on death, which Whitman asserts is not the end, but just another movement in the larger flux. And he concludes, all goes outward and onward, and nothing collapses, and to die is different from what anyone supposed, and luckier. Well, this evening's section from Song of Myself, part 7 of the large poem, picks up this audacious statement about its being luckier to die than we supposed. Here's what he says. Has anyone supposed it lucky to be born? I hasten to inform him or her it is just as lucky to die, and I know it. I pass death with the dying and birth with the new-washed babe, and am not contained between my hat and boots, and peruse manifold objects, no two alike, and every one good. The earth good and the stars good, and their adjuncts all good. I am not an earth, nor an adjunct of an earth. I am the mate and companion of people, all just as immortal and fathomless as myself. They do not know how immortal, but I know. Every kind for itself and its own. For me, mine, male and female. For me, all that have been boys and that love women. For me, the man that is proud and feels how it stings to be slighted. For me, the sweetheart and the old maid. For me, mothers and the mothers of mothers. For me, lips that have smiled, eyes that have shed tears. For me, children and the begetters of children. Who need be afraid of the merge? Undrape. You are not guilty to me, nor stale, nor discarded. I see through the broadcloth and gingham, whether or no, and am around, tenacious, acquisitive, tireless, and can never be shaken away. Has anyone supposed it lucky to be born? Yes, I suppose many of us have, at least in our more open-hearted and generous moments. Okay, says Whitman, let's start there. It's lucky to be born, right? Well, I hasten to inform him or her it is just as lucky to die, and I know it. And I know it, forsooth. That's all the proof Whitman needs, all the proof he feels we need, too. He has experienced the luckiness of death, and remember what he told us at the very beginning of the poem. What I assume, you shall assume. Apparently, if we read this poem right, then, yes, we too will understand the experience he is speaking of. Whitman says he passes death with the dying and birth with the new-washed babe. Why? What is he? Some sort of midwife hospice nurse? Well, actually, yes, in a way. He was there with the dying, but that was several years after he wrote Song of Myself. Let's pause for a moment to look into Whitman's experiences with the dying. During the Civil War, Whitman went down to Washington and places around Washington to visit the wounded soldiers in hospital, bringing them little gifts or books, or just sitting with them, sometimes writing letters back home for them. He recorded his experiences and published them in his book Specimen Days. Let's attend to a few passages. Here's one describing his general practice in the wards. I am back again in Washington on my regular daily and nightly rounds. Of course, there are many specialties. Dotting a ward here and there are always cases of poor fellows, long-suffering under obstinate wounds, or weak and disheartened from typhoid fever or the like. Marked cases needing special and sympathetic nourishment. These I sit down and either talk to or silently cheer them up. They always like it hugely, and so do I. Each case has its peculiarities and needs some new adaptation. I have learnt to thus conform, learnt a good deal of hospital wisdom. Some of these poor young chaps, away from home for the first time in their lives, hunger and thirst for affection. This is sometimes the only thing that will reach their condition. The men like to have a pencil and something to write in. I have given them cheap pocket diaries and almanacs for 1864, interleaved with blank paper. For reading, I generally have some old pictorial magazines or story papers. They're always acceptable. Also, the morning or evening papers of the day. The best books I do not give, but lend to read through the wards and then take them to others and so on. They're very punctual about returning the books. In these wards, or on the field, as I thus continue to go around, I have come to adapt myself to each emergency after its kind or call, however trivial, however solemn, every one justified and made real under its circumstances. Not only visits and cheering talk and little gifts, not only washing and dressing wounds, I have some cases where the patient is unwilling anyone should do this but me, but passages from the Bible, expounding them, prayer at the bedside, explanations of doctrine, etc. I think I see my friends smiling at this confession, but I was never more in earnest in my life. In camp and everywhere, I was in the habit of reading or giving recitations to the men. They were very fond of it and liked declamatory, poetical passages. We would gather in a large group by ourselves after supper and spend the time in such readings or in talking, and occasionally by an amusing game called the Game of 20 Questions. And here are three short descriptions of some of the men Whitman viewed and visited. In one of the hospitals, I find Thomas Haley, a regular Irish boy, a fine specimen of youthful physical manliness, shot through the lungs, inevitably dying. Came over to this country from Ireland to enlist, has not a single friend or acquaintance here, is sleeping soundly at this moment, but it is the sleep of death, has a bullet hole straight through the lung. I saw Tom when first brought here 3 days since and didn't suppose he would live 12 hours. Yet he looks well enough in the face to a casual observer. He lies there with his frame exposed above the waist, all naked for coolness. A fine-built man, the tan not yet bleached from his cheeks and neck. It's useless to talk to him, as with his sad hurt and the stimulants they give him and the utter strangeness of every object, face, furniture, etc. The poor fellow, even when awake, is like some frightened, shy animal. Much of the time, he sleeps, or half sleeps. Sometimes I thought he knew more than he showed. I often come and sit by him in perfect silence. He will breathe for 10 minutes, as softly and evenly as a young babe asleep. Poor youth, so handsome, athletic, with profuse, beautiful, shining hair. One time, as I sat looking at him while he lay asleep, he suddenly, without the least start, awakened, opened his eye, gave me a long, steady look, turning his face very slightly to gaze easier. One long, clear, silent look, a slight sigh, then turned back and went into his doze again. Little he knew, poor death-stricken boy, the heart of the stranger that hovered near. In one bed, a young man, Marcus Small, sick with dysentery and typhoid fever. Pretty critical case. I talk with him often. He thinks he will die. Looks like it, indeed. I write a letter for him home to East Livermore, Maine. I let him talk to me a little, but not much. Advise him to keep very quiet. Do most of the talking myself. Stay quite a while with him as he holds on to my hand. Talk to him in a cheering but slow, low, and measured manner. Talk about his furlough and going home as soon as he is able to travel. Opposite, an old Quaker lady is sitting by the side of her son, Amor Moore, shot in the head 2 weeks since. Very low, quite rational. From hips down, paralyzed. He will surely die. I speak a very few words to him every day and evening. He answers pleasantly, wants nothing. He told me soon after he came about his home affairs. His mother had been an invalid, and he feared to let her know his condition. He died soon after she came.
Confidere in me, Domino.
I thought we needed a little musical break after those heavy passages. We heard the Taizé chant Confitemini Domino. These, then, describe some of Whitman's experiences passing death with the dying, which happened, as I said, several years after he wrote the poem. Poems have a way of reenacting themselves later on in life. Oh, by the way, while we've paused, let's remind ourselves that we're here at Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson. But we left the poem at a critical point. I pass death with the dying, Whitman says, and birth with the new washed babe, and am not contained between my hat and boots. Here's an outrageous vaunt, which feels wiser the more we attend to it. Some people see themselves as indeed contained between their hat and boots. What more is there of them than their bodies, which can be located between top of head and bottom of feet? Health for them is everything, and physical well-being. All that they know comes to them through their senses, and that whole world they are perceiving is something other than they are. These people may be fine, lovely people, but they live limited lives, especially limited interior lives, contained merely between their hat and boots. Whitman declares that he is not contained between my hat and boots. Why not? Because his imagination, his spirit, reaches out beyond himself, beyond his own perspective on things, assuming other people's perspectives, feeling what they feel. He's there with those being born, there with those dying. Materialists today would say that he's only projecting his own psyche onto others and has no way of entering the experience of others. And yes, for almost all of us, we are going to project something of ourselves into our perceptions. That's the projection of the ego. But to the extent that we can rise above the ego, even for a short moment or two, then we can feel the other person as that person is. This is what John Keats called negative capability, a necessary attribute of the poet, who, Keats put it, is the most unpoetical of anything in existence because he has no identity. He is continually filling some other body. We are talking about a kind of intuitive perception of the world outside us, and this perception obliterates the difference between us and them. We merge with what is out there. We are in a moment of unity, and maybe just a moment only, but that is enough. We've all experienced this, though we may not have been aware of it. Whitman sees it as one of his tasks to reawaken us to this unifying, intuitive relationship with all things. What happens when Whitman extends himself to feel others' experience? He peruses manifold objects, no two alike, and every one good. Getting inside people and things makes us realize that each person and each thing is individual, unique, and good. And we perceive the deep mystery in everyone, all being just as immortal and fathomless as myself. Whitman then adds that they do not know how immortal, but I know. We're beyond logic now. We're in the world of the fathomless, where we must perceive by the egoless intuition as our spirit reaches out, unbounded by the limits of material constraints and death. Whitman is aware of his spirit doing this, and so he can be aware of others' intuitive spirits, even if they're not aware of it themselves. And then comes another catalogue, celebrating every kind for itself and its own. It's not a long catalogue, 7 statements, beginning, "For me." All these different kinds of people in the world, with their individual experiences, and I enter into each one, making each one mine, too. For me, mine, male and female. Of course he's going to join himself to both male and female to become androgynous. He's unifying himself to the whole world. He has to take on both yin and yang. For me, all that have been boys and that love women. For me, the man that is proud and feels how it stings to be slighted. For me, the sweetheart and the old maid. For me, mothers and the mothers of mothers. For me, lips that have smiled, eyes that have shed tears. For me, children and the begetters of children. It's an interesting list of characters. Whitman embraces both those who are enjoying reciprocal relationships with others and those who are not. Boys that love women and men who are slighted by women. The woman who is someone's sweetheart and the woman who remains an old maid. The mothers who have their children and, well, let's double it to the mothers of these mothers, a three-generational mutual relationship, as well as the children and the begetters of children. Both these sets of relationships can share love back and forth with lips that have smiled, or they can be without love, with eyes that have shed tears. Whitman will take in all these experiences. Does it seem frightening to extend oneself in this open-spirited, intuitive manner? Whitman is aware that we might be scared, but he wants to reassure us in his odd manner. Who need be afraid of the merge, he asks. The merge, that's what it's all about, as we lose our ego and merge with others to become one. Who need be afraid of the merge? Undrape. Take off your clothes. Reveal yourself, vulnerable and open. What would make us hesitate to take off clothes in front of someone else? Well, shame, probably. We're ashamed of some aspect of ourselves and so cover up. But Whitman assures us that from his soul's point of view, he does not judge us. Remember, he just told us that he sees everyone as good. No shame, then. So don't be afraid of the merge. Undrape. You are not guilty to me, nor stale, nor discarded. As in an earlier section, Whitman is describing this kind of soul work through sexual imagery. This is a kind of seduction scene. Earlier, we watched as his soul settled its head athwart my hips and gently turned over upon me. Now he's seducing our soul. He's apparently already undressed our soul with his eyes. I see through the broadcloth and gingham whether or no. And what's worse, he's a stalker, and he's not going to leave us alone. He's quite open in reminding us that he is around, tenacious, acquisitive, tireless, and can never be shaken away. And with all that, do we consent to the seduction? Are we afraid, or can we put our ego aside and, with no shame, merge with Whitman? In any case, let us now, at the end of this section, see if we can at least merge with the poem. We've finished analyzing it, and now we just experience it one more time, letting the words enter into us, seducing us, stalking us, but never judging us. Has anyone supposed it lucky to be born? I hasten to inform him or her it is just as lucky to die, and I know it. I pass death with the dying and birth with the new-washed babe, and am not contained between my hat and boots, and peruse manifold objects, no two alike, and every one good. The earth good, and the stars good, and their adjuncts all good. I am not an earth, nor an adjunct of an earth. I am the mate and companion of people, all just as immortal and fathomless as myself. They do not know how immortal, but I know. Every kind for itself and its own. For me, mine, male and female. For me, all that have been boys and that love women. For me, the man that is proud and feels how it stings to be slighted. For me, the sweetheart and the old maid. For me, mothers and the mothers of mothers. For me, lips that have smiled, eyes that have shed tears. For me, children and the begetters of children. Who need be afraid of the merge? Undrape. You are not guilty to me, nor stale, nor discarded. I see through the broadcloth and gingham whether or no, and am around, tenacious, acquisitive, tireless, and can never be shaken away. And that's the Whitman passage for this week. We were talking then about the space between us all, and all those people who hide themselves behind a wall of illusion, who never glimpse the truth till it's far too late, when they pass away. They do not know how immortal, but I know. And then, if we could merge with each other, think about the love we all could share when we find it, and try our best to hold it there with our love, which could save the world if they only knew. But I know. Whitman can invite us along with him, but he can't really change us. We have to realize that it's all within ourselves. No one else can make us change. After all, we're really only very small, and life flows on within us and without us. All goes onward and outward, and nothing collapses. And then there are those people whose love has gone so cold that they gain the world, wear ribbons, stars, and all that, but lose their soul. They don't know, but we want to ask ourselves if we are one of them, one of those Berkeys who struts and stares and all that. What's the point of all this? Well, when we've seen beyond ourselves, then we may find that peace of mind is waiting there. And as Whitman will remind us over and over in his poem, the time will come when we see we are all one, and life flows on within us and without us. Well, that was odd. It was as though I merged Whitman's passage with George Harrison's Within You, Without You. This song is credited to the Beatles, but George was the only one of the four appearing on this track. The rest were Indian musicians and string players from the London Symphony Orchestra. Well, we're coming near to the end this evening under lamplight, but there's one more event we can't let pass without some attention. This past Sunday was Leonard Cohen's 80th birthday, and that's something to raise a glass to from all of us around the world. We'll toast Leonard first by attending to one of his oddest songs, Because Of, from the Dear Heather album of 2004. I choose this song partly because, well, it's just weird, with its eerie music and even eerier voice of Leonard, who begins by just reciting, but then makes a half-hearted attempt to sing before giving up and speaking again. And I choose it partly because, in its way, it fits what Whitman's been talking about, as Leonard acknowledges the fathomless depths of the women, and the women then undrape, becoming naked in their different ways, opening themselves with no shame to be looked at by the aged poet. It's a poem that maybe Whitman might have produced in his old age, accepting his own frailty with humility and good humor, graceful and grateful.
Because of a few songs wherein I spoke of their mystery, women have been exceptionally kind to my old age. They make a secret place in their busy lives, and they take me there. They become naked in their different ways, and they say,
Because Of, let's attend to If It Be Your Will, a very moving song. The song first appeared in 1984, 30 years ago for goodness sake, and the version we'll hear is from the live album from 1994, only 20 years ago. In his 2009 concerts, Leonard gave his own introduction to the song. It was a while ago, faced with some obstacles, that I wrote a song, well, it's more of a prayer. With typical modesty, he plays down the enormous problems he'd been facing with the understatement, some obstacles. Let this be a prayer on behalf of all of us facing some obstacles blocking our path, making it look like we'll have to give up everything we find most rewarding, everything that comes out of us melodious and graceful like a song. Here, Leonard, and we too, face the dry time, the dark night, when it looks like he'll speak no more, he'll have no chance to express himself and reach out to others. That's hard enough for ordinary folk like you and me, but it must come even harder for someone like Leonard Cohen, most of whose career has been spent speaking out in poetry and song to huge numbers of people. But he submits to the hell he finds himself in, with the faith that this may be the way to make him well. Notice the way the song moves from darkness to a joyful acceptance, and then a final union with all your children here in their rags of light, in our rags of light. He's one of these children, not now in complete darkness, but clothed at least in rags of light. Who can measure how deep this goes? Leonard shows himself, in Whitman's words, as the mate and companion of people, all just as immortal and fathomless as himself. And he speaks for all of us as we abide on this broken hill. We'll run through the words to attend to their painful, then joyful compassion before we move into the song itself. But first, it's a warm equinox good night from me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, pleased to have shared with you this evening under lamplight on Cambridge 105. If it be your will that I speak no more, and my voice be still as it was before, I will speak no more, I shall abide until I am spoken for, if it be your will. If it be your will that a voice be true from this broken hill, I will sing to you. From this broken hill, all your praises they shall ring, if it be your will to let me sing. If it be your will, if there is a choice, let the rivers fill, let the hills rejoice, let your mercy spill on all these burning hearts in hell, if it be your will to make us well. And draw us near, and bind us tight, all your children here in their rags of light, in our rags of light, all dressed to kill, and end this night, if it be your will, if it be your will.
If it be your will, let us speak no more, and my voice be still as it was before. I will speak no more, I shall abide until I am spoken for, if it be your will. If it be your will, if a voice be true from this broken hill, I will sing to you. From this broken hill, all your praises they shall ring, if it be your will to let me sing. Your will, if there is a choice, let the rivers fill, let the hills rejoice, let your mercy spill on all these burning hearts in hell.